Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida State University makes a controversial choice in appointing a state senator as president of the school based on his fundraising ability.
I'm very concerned about our raising our expectations that there's going to be a giant pool of money when it's not going to happen.
Also this week, a first debate in one of the country's more critical congressional contests has some heated moments.
Congressman, I would just expect that you live by what you say. And you did not in that case.
We'll also talk about the fallout from a tragic Florida murder case, the least known of the three state constitutional amendments Florida voters will decide in November, and what's happening along the state's Gulf Coast 4 years after the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Florida State University has picked St. Augustine Republican State Senator John Thrasher as its next president. His selection follows months of discord as some FSU faculty and students demanded the role be filled by an academic instead. This week, those tensions boiled over at a turbulent final two search meetings. Florida Public Radio's Jessica Palumbo was there.
Who better to convey the drama of FSU's presidential search than someone who masters dramatic flair for a living? Enter Matthew Lotta.
My function here at Florida State is to direct operas.
That's the professor talking to the university's presidential search committee.
And this whole process has actually kind of reminded me of an opera. We've had heroes and we've had high drama. We've had villains. We've had choruses of ascent.
For one, I don't think you can question his passion, his loyalty. I think he bleeds garnet and gold.
He just shows a true appreciation and love for this university. And I think that we're at a time now where we can have this true seminal leader.
We have John Thrasher, who certainly understands funding and state politics and fundraising.
I think he is an inspiring leader who can help us heal, which we need healing right now. And with that being said, I would like to make the motion to name John Thrasher our next president.
Second.
And choruses of dissent.
Having ties to the legislature, of course, is an important point, but it's not the only point.
I'm worried about the message that you're going to send if you appoint him, because appointing him would be incredibly dismissive of the faculty.
John Thrasher may be your friend, but you need to tell him no.
Right now, it's too scary. This is the scary choice, not the safe choice.
We almost had a battle scene. What we don't have is a finale, and we don't know what the ending is going to be.
When the curtain fell, the trustees had made their controversial choice on a vote of 11-2. Before that, though, they interviewed the soon-to-be president. Here are some of Thrasher's thoughts in response to their questions. First up, athletics.
Clearly, so many of our friends and people who are out there who care and love Florida State University look at the face, and sometimes that's athletics. But athletics should not be promoted any higher than anything else in our university. It should be comparable to everything else we do.
Thrasher says to break into the top 25 of research institutions, he hopes to realign faculty salaries with those at other top institutions and hire more faculty, both of which require more money.
Whether it's the private sector that we hope we get a chance to talk about, or the public sector, or grants and other things from the federal government. All of those go to getting us to the top 25.
Thrasher also addressed becoming what trustee Peggy Rolando called a lightning rod during the search process. The Faculty Senate unanimously passed a resolution supporting any of the three finalists besides Thrasher, and several faculty and students had publicly expressed opposition to his candidacy.
And I respect the people who have differences of opinion about myself and my qualifications. And all I can say is if I become president of Florida State University, I will reach out to anybody who wants to sit down and talk about opportunities to advance this university.
Thrasher's presidency still has one more hurdle to get over before becoming official. The State University System Board of Governors is expected to vote on the matter in early November. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
The hoopla surrounding the picking of a new FSU president wasn't the only drama in the capital city this week. The principals in one of America's hottest congressional races were also meeting face-to-face for the first time in a debate. It was Democratic challenger Gwen Graham taking on Republican incumbent Steve Sutherland for Florida's sprawling 2nd Congressional District. The issues included the Federal Affordable Care Act, with Graham urging tweaks to the existing law.
I was the only Democratic challenger that came out publicly and said I would have supported the Republican Keep Your Health Plan Act.
Sutherland was all for repeal and replace.
House Republicans have put forth many different solutions.
Then there was the minimum wage issue. Graham, all for ramping it up.
So I would support an incremental increase in the minimum wage so as not to hurt the businesses.
Sutherland, not all that happy with the fact the minimum wage exists at all.
We need to be focused really on how we're going to increase wages for all of America.
The issues of support for veterans programs, the war on terror, and government spending also came up. And then Congressman Sutherland insisted the fact he supported the less strict House version of the Violence Against Women Act did not mean he was somehow anti-woman.
The fact is, I have supported this legislation, and as a father of four daughters, I will always stand in defense of women.
Drawing this reaction from Gwen Graham.
Congressman, that's just a lie. That is just a lie.
There were a few more testy exchanges during the encounter. Graham and Sutherland are set to square off again in Tallahassee on October 15th. Still to come on Capitol Report, in the wake of last week's murder-suicide in a small North Florida town, could the legislature be getting ready to step in?
Situations such as the Bell incident, so tragic, that we certainly want to know exactly what happened, analyze it, and see what it tells us.
There are three amendments that will be before voters on the November ballot, but is the last one, Amendment 3, being overlooked? Meanwhile, life is getting ever tougher for the oyster harvesters along Florida's Gulf Coast.
They're worried how they're going to feed their families for today. But if we keep on looking for today, well, we are not going to have much tomorrow.
And if Florida lawmakers ultimately disconnect legalized card games from dog tracks, could that spell the end for dog tracks? State child welfare officials are looking into what went wrong in their handling of an investigation of a Florida man who shot himself and his family in North Florida. The Florida Department of Children and Families say they were actually investigating the man weeks before the mass shooting in Bell. So, as Sasha Cordner reports, in the wake of the deadly rampage, could lawmakers be considering another DCF legislative fix?
Gilchrist County 911, what's the address of the emergency?
Yes, ma'am. I just shot my daughter and shot all my grandkids, and I'll be sitting on my step, and when you get here, I'm going to shoot myself.
About a week ago, Don Spirit shot his 28-year-old daughter, Sarah, and her six kids, ranging in age from about a three-month-old baby to 11 years old. After calling 911 and warning the operator he would commit suicide when Gilchrist County Sheriff's deputies arrived on the scene, Don Spirit followed through and shot himself at his Bell home, as later confirmed by Sheriff Robert Schultz following the incident.
First deputy on scene made contact with the subject, who later committed suicide. Deputies searched the residence, which revealed multiple victims with apparent gunshot wounds inside the residence.
The day after the shooting, Governor Rick Scott visited the North Florida town, and speaking to reporters following a cabinet meeting Tuesday, he said he's still in contact with authorities in Bell.
I spoke to the sheriff, the superintendent, and the principal yesterday, and to see if there's anything that they needed from the state.
As details continue to unfold, it's been discovered that 2 weeks before the shooting, someone had called the Florida Department of Children and Families Child Abuse Hotline to complain that adults in the home were using drugs in front of the kids, a claim that state child welfare officials say they had been investigating. In addition, officials say both Don Spirit and his daughter were the focus of several past abuse and neglect investigations, and now Governor Rick Scott says he has the agency looking into it.
We don't ever want this to happen in our state again.
And Stewart Republican Representative Gail Harrell agrees. She was in charge of this year's effort in the House to overhaul DCF after a series of investigative Miami Herald reports outlined a number of child abuse-related deaths that occurred under the agency's supervision.
A good example of the change that has happened is that we have this rapid response team out there doing the investigation. So we should have, within the next week or so, some preliminary indication as to what exactly went on and what went wrong. It will help us make decisions and DCF make decisions as where to go from here.
Still, she says moving forward, she expects there will be a lot of hearings when the legislature next convenes, starting with committee hearings in January. But she says for now, she's taking a wait-and-see approach as to what shakes out from the DCF probe, especially given the new law reforming the system just took effect months ago.
And if the new law is not going to address that, we need to learn about that and perhaps take further steps. But let's see what shakes out of the investigation, and also let's see how these changes in the new law could have had an impact. I think they will have a significant impact. And it makes me even more determined to move forward as we go down this road of reform and changing the whole system and making sure that the safety of the child is paramount.
In addition to DCF, local authorities are also conducting their own probe. That includes how Dawn Spirit had a gun with a felony record. The elder Spirit had a troubled past, which includes serving time in prison for accidentally fatally shooting his 8-year-old son in the head during a hunting trip in 2001. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Three proposed state constitutional amendments are slated for Florida's November ballot. So far, most of the media and the public's attention has been paid to two of them. But as Lynn Hatter reports, the one proposal that could have the most impact on state policy is the one many people are overlooking.
Some political watchers say Florida is heading toward a crisis in the judicial system.
The deal is that we're going to have three Supreme Court justices retiring. So there's a question of if the incoming governor or the existing governor gets to appoint the new justices.
In January of 2019, the terms of Florida Supreme Court Justices Barbara Pariente, Peggy Quince, and Fred Lewis expire. The justices are turning 70, the mandatory retirement age for the state Supreme Court. But the ending of their terms coincides with the start of a new gubernatorial term. And that, says League of Women Voters of Florida Executive Director Jessica Lowe Minor, is where things get hairy.
Well, so there has been some kind of unclarity in the past. Mm-hmm. However, in 2006, the Florida Supreme Court issued an interpretation mm-hmm. in which they said that, you know, a new judge or justice cannot be appointed until a vacancy actually exists. Well, so in the situation that, you know, a vacancy exists, it's very clear that the new governor has already taken office.
But the Supreme Court's view does not make it law. The issue has come up once before, during the transition period between former governors Lawton Chiles and Jeb Bush. Chiles appointed Justice Quince to the bench right before he left the governor's mansion, and Bush affirmed the appointment. But Amendment 3 would have given Chiles sole authority over Quince's appointment. Now there are three seats up for grabs, and those justices, along with the rest of the court, decide everything from whether amendments appear on the ballot to whether state laws are constitutional. Minor says Amendment 3 could give the next governor an unprecedented amount of power.
Those vacancies will actually be opening at the end of whomever is elected in this upcoming fall election, whether it is Rick Scott, whether it is Charlie Crist. The end of their term is when those four justices would expire. So if Amendment 3 passes, the governor who is elected in this upcoming November 4th election will have the power to determine the entire balance of the Florida Supreme Court.
But Amendment 3 has largely been overlooked. Instead, the public debate has centered on whether Florida should amend the Constitution to allow for medical marijuana or whether there should be a dedicated funding source for land conservation. Both are important issues, but Florida Tax Watch's Winner says they could be solved legislatively. Amendment 3, he says, is the only measure that should be before voters.
You can't clarify Amendment 3 legislatively. It would have to be done in the Constitution. So that's the difference.
At the end of the day, it could be one of the most important election decisions voters will make. Supporters say it will alleviate confusion over judicial appointments, while opponents argue an outgoing governor should not be able to appoint people who will serve under a new governor. The League of Women Voters of Florida is opposed to Amendment 3, while Florida Tax Watch is neutral. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
This month marks 4 years since the capping of the BP oil spill, and while some say Florida's made a full recovery since the disaster, Regan McCarthy reports others are left waiting for the help they need to put their lives back together again.
In the aftermath of the BP oil spill, most Floridians had two main concerns. What would the news mean for the environment? And what about tourism, and by extension, the economy?
The environment is the economy.
That's Janet Bowman, the Director of Policies and Strategies for the Nature Conservancy. She says the two go hand in hand. When the environment is in trouble, so is the economy. And working to get the environment cleaned back up means the economy starts to go back up. And she says that's exactly what's happening now.
Certainly, Florida experienced a banner tourism year this past year, but clearly, I mean, that shows how important having, having an attractive Gulf Coast is for Florida's economy.
In fact, Florida's on track to have a record number of visitors for the fourth year in a row. And Visit Florida's chief marketing officer, Paul Phipps, says the record extends to the Gulf Coast.
Well, and that's why there's record revenues. I mean, bed tax, what you can look at is bed tax revenue. Bed tax revenue across the state is up in every county. Some counties as much as 15% year over year. I can tell you South Walton area, they set all-time record bed tax revenues in July.
Although Phipps admits there are some areas in the state that have bounced back more slowly and are therefore still recovering. But Restaurant and Lodging Association President Carol Dover has a different take. She says while there's no doubt she's seen improvement and she thanks Visit Florida for its work, the situation isn't as sunny as some might say.
It always is going to depend on who you're talking to. You know, the people who have received their checks and their numbers are up have put this oil spill far behind them because they don't have ripple effects from it. But then I know of people, I know of a boat captain just last week who got his claim denied again.
Dover says she knows that captain personally and knows his business took a significant hit for several seasons due to the effects of the oil spill. After the oil spill, many impacted business owners hope to recover losses caused by the spill through funds provided by the government or lawsuits and settlements. And Dover says that's worked for some, but for others it hasn't, or at least not yet. And she points out just because the number of visitors in the state is making records doesn't mean the revenue business owners are collecting from tourists is.
Let's say, if you were at that particular time prior to the oil spill, maybe charging close to $200 a night for a room, and now you're still only getting $100 or $150, then yes, you might be full. But it doesn't mean that at the end of the day your P&L statement isn't strong because you may very well be charging less to get people to come here.
Dover says decreasing prices can be done quickly, but increasing the standard rate back up is a much slower process. Phipps points out the average daily rate paid for a bed in Florida is $128. That trumps the national rate of $115. But despite that, Dover says there's no question the effects of the oil spill and recovery haven't been equal.
There's no question that this oil spill, there are still people out there that have a very huge and heavy impact on their life and their livelihood.
Dover says there's no need to look far to find a community that's still struggling. One example is Apalachicola. While no oil ever reached the bay during the spill, some worried it would. As a result, many people overharvested the oysters in the area, which had already been diminishing due to a drought and increased water salinity in the bay. Add to that concerns about tourism and Gulf seafood, and you get a community that 4 years later is still fighting for its life. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
And as long as we're prowling the Big Bend coastal region of Florida, the state's Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has put restrictions on the Apalachicola Bay oyster harvest this winter. But harvesting may need to stop altogether if stocks don't improve. Nick Evans reports government officials are calling for financial and educational support if the commission closes the bay, but it's not clear how useful that can be.
Apalachicola Bay's oyster industry has been struggling for years as declining freshwater from Georgia has led to a decline in oyster stocks. It's gotten so bad Florida has even filed a lawsuit against Georgia in the U.S. Supreme Court. But it appears that will do little in the short term. Just this week, the U.S. Solicitor General recommended the court shelve the case for about a year while the Army Corps of Engineers determines how it wants to distribute water. Meanwhile, Florida's Fish and Wildlife Commission has put restrictions on this winter's oyster harvest. But here, too, it's not clear how much the limitations can help.
There's nothing right now that could happen for this bay to stay open right now. It is in such critical condition till if it stays open and stays getting harvest like it is, we're prolonging the bay to come back quicker.
That's Shannon Hartsfield with the Franklin County Seafood Workers Association. He says even with harvest limitations, it's going to be difficult for the bay to recover.
To give you an idea, when our bay is healthy, there's like, 800-900 bushels an acre, and it's down to less than 100 bushels per acre.
The problem is fresh water. Oysters thrive in brackish waters, places like Apalachicola Bay, where river water mixes with salt water from the Gulf of Mexico. But Hartsfield believes even with fresh water restored, it will take a while for the oyster population to rebound.
And even though we got a peak, a good peak of fresh water there for a while last year, it bounced, right back down to where it was. I mean, it would take some good flows for about 2 to 3 years to get our bay back to where it needs to be when you're talking about fresh water.
If the bay closes, Florida Governor Rick Scott and Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam say it will be important for the government to step in and support oystermen that find themselves out of work. Here's Scott.
The most important thing we can do is take care of the citizens that live there that have been dependent on it. And I mean, we've done the right thing from the standpoint of suing the state of Georgia. We've done the right thing from the standpoint of investing. But we've got to do the right thing for the people that live down there.
This raises another problem, though, because much of the support comes in the form of education and job training. But Hartsfield says some of the oystermen don't have the basic skills necessary to get into those programs.
So then what? Your reading scale level so low, your math scale level so low. To go to a vo-tech school, you got to score a certain level. And they don't. And so it's hard for them to take advantage of something that they're not qualified to do.
Hartsfield says one possibility is putting oystermen to work reshelling the seabed. Previous efforts have focused on large-scale barge operations, and if it's done right, this can be very cost-effective. But Hartsfield says they aren't always getting shells to the right places. He says the hand-shelling program, which is getting $4.5 million of federal money, is more precise and it uses oystermen familiar with the bay. But that program has its limitations, too.
It would put quite a few people to work. How many, I don't know, because the qualifications is you have to make 80% of your living in this bay, and you had to be making it, in 2012 when the disaster was declared, or the fishery failure was declared, and you have to pass a drug test.
It's clear the bay is in trouble, and until reliable levels of fresh water return, it seems likely to stay that way. In the meantime, the people that rely on the waterfront to feed their families have to hope stopgap measures are enough to sustain them. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
You're listening to Capitol Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, supporters of legislation that could dramatically reduce greyhound racing in the state will once again be making their case in next year's legislative session. As Joe Roberts of member station WQCS reports, supporters are working to raise grassroots support for the proposal, which has come close to passing in recent sessions.
Florida is one of seven states in the U.S. which still hosts greyhound racing. Of 21 greyhound tracks, 12 of them are in the Sunshine State. These tracks can host poker rooms as well, but only if they continue live racing. Carrie Teal is executive director of Grey2K USA, a greyhound advocacy group, and he would like the state's legislators to eliminate the racing requirement.
Something that all of the major animal protection organizations, both in Florida and nationally, are against.
Teal says the group would like to see greyhound racing and other forms of gambling decoupled. They've come close in the legislature before and hope to be successful in the coming year.
I think you would see greyhound racing slowly end and slowly be phased out over perhaps a decade.
For the most part, Joseph Rooney, vice president of the Palm Beach Kennel Club, agrees. He doesn't object to decoupling, but says racing wouldn't stop in Palm Beach.
We would be one, and I would guess Jacksonville would be one, and probably Derby Lane would probably continue to run live. The rest of them, I think, would fade out over the next year or two.
For most greyhound tracks, Teal says maintaining racing is not economically feasible.
Dog tracks are now losing so much money on greyhound racing, and even the state is losing money on greyhound racing. The cost of regulating this activity now outweighs the revenue that's coming in. So the state is losing on this. The dog tracks is losing. The only people who are benefiting are the greyhound breeders.
Again, he and Rooney of the Palm Beach Kennel Club are pretty much in agreement.
Each track's different size and scope, but, I mean, it's probably, at the very least, $1 million savings to stop racing live in terms of the overhead that it costs to put the performances on. And that means a lot to smaller tracks that don't do well with their live racing.
Teal says Florida is one of two states which does not require reporting of greyhound injuries, and he'd like to see that change.
How greyhound cruelty cases are handled by state regulators, that's another serious issue that needs to be addressed. You know, we're seeing cases of greyhound neglect and cases of greyhound cruelty occur, and it takes 2 years or 3 years for the state to take disciplinary action.
While the Palm Beach Kennel Club doesn't own the dogs that race there, Rooney says the dogs' well-being is monitored.
We have thrown kennels out that have not abide by the guidelines that we've set. We don't put up with it. It's obviously very bad for our business. If we hear of anything happening that's not on the up and up, we simply just don't continue to work with those kennels.
He also notes that racetracks are contributors to local economies.
A lot of these racetracks, like us, we employ hundreds of people. You know, we have a significant economic impact in Palm Beach County, both directly with our employment and with the vendors that we use and the taxes that we raise and the tourism that we help to foster.
Rooney says he does expect the decoupling legislation and other safety measures will pass in the coming legislative session. For Florida Public Radio, this is Jill Roberts in Fort Pierce.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Nick Evans, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.